The questions you ask are more important than the answers you get. I think that should be the mantra of every public opinion researcher and consumer of polls. More important, good researchers must be inquisitive, open-minded, and prepared to understand and appreciate the true nature of the human being who is about to be tasked with completing your questionnaire. My guest this week on In Focus knows a thing or two about writing survey questionnaires. She wrote a book about it. I'm David Coletto. Welcome back to In Focus. Dr. Annie Pettit is a public opinion and market researcher with more than 20 years' experience working with some of the leading research agencies in Canada. Dr. Pettit has a PhD in psychology from York University, where she specialized in online survey data quality. She currently consults for a range of traditional and technology research suppliers, is a member of the Canadian Research Insights Council Standards Committee, and is chair of the Canadian ISO Standards Committee. She's also the author of the book, People Aren't Robots, Practical Guide to the Psychology and Technique of Questionnaire Design, published in 2016. She joined me this week to talk about asking questions, writing questionnaires, and why this step in the research process is so important. Hope you enjoy the discussion. Annie, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I've been a big fan of your work and I've gotten to know you a little bit. Our worlds are a little apart because you're mainly in the consumer kind of market research world. I'm more in the public affairs world. So welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. And I've crossed paths with you similarly in the online world, and I'm amazed at the level of detail and expertise that you're able to showcase in the social space. So well done on that. I'm glad to chat with you today.
Well, thanks so much. So I've been starting most of my conversations with researchers trying to get at whether they have an overarching framework or philosophy that guides, you know, how they either measure public opinion or market behavior, how they analyze it, you know, and thinking about, you know, where people's impetus for decision making comes from. Do you have kind of that guiding light that pulls you in a particular direction?
I'll approach this from perhaps a strange point of view, which actually ties in with what we're going to talk about today. I know that everything about me, all my beliefs, behaviors, all that is biased. It comes from a biased place. I can't possibly understand you or other people across Canada and other countries. I don't have that personal experience with all the different types of people out there, which means I really appreciate what social media offers. I know that there is no truth in social media, but I know that I can go there to see the breadth of opinion, the breadth of understanding of options of people. So one of the things I really do like to do is when I'm starting to puzzle out a new issue, a new topic, is go direct to Twitter, LinkedIn, and now today, TikTok. I may disagree completely with all the opinions out there, but these sources are guaranteed to introduce me to opinions that I had not thought of before and that I couldn't even make up, which means I'm better prepared to lay out a research plan for whatever it may be, whatever I might be interacting with.
And that's a really good point, right? That without that, it's almost a type of priming in a way, right? That if you just sit down and say, okay, I want to study why do Canadians, you know, decide where to travel on vacation, or why do they vote the way they vote? And you just start coming up with hypotheses, you're right. Those are going to be largely driven by the biases that as a researcher, we will bring to that question. And so if you kind of, and another researcher I interviewed said the same thing, I kind of start with a blank slate and I say, let me just listen. right? And you wrote actually a book, Listening Lady, which is
yeah.
funny, right? I'm just going to listen to what people, or read in the case of social media, read what people are saying, and then create sort of a conceptual framework to understand how to then explore this through the tools we have, which I find really interesting. You're somebody, when I follow you on social media too. I actually haven't had the chance to see you speak, but you do a lot of conferences and speaking, and it's very apparent to me that you love research and you love what you do. So I guess, what is it about social and market research that drives you and brings so much passion to your work and your and makes you so curious, I guess?
Data itself is just the funnest thing ever. You can collect all your data, but there's good data and bad data in there. And there's, for me, it's just a big game of figuring out what is the good data, what is the misleading data. You know, once I can separate that, what's hidden in the data? What are the surprises in there? You know, you can chart any set of data and get whatever, a nice bar chart, a nice line chart, whatever chart it may be. But if you just stick a different variable in there or look at a different subgroup, just tease little things apart, you're suddenly looking at a brand new insight. So beyond the data into actually something that had never occurred to you before. You couldn't guess that it just by rearranging the data, you've suddenly got something that you'd never thought of before, which is fascinating. You know, we like to think we're so smart. We know everything. You know, I've done too many years of education. I've done all the psychology classes, and then I throw in a new variable and like, what? I don't know what I'm looking at anymore. So it's pretty fun.
I love that. It's just like, and it's the, I also find I'm constantly re-engaged in it because I learn something new every day, right? Like you assume a lot and then those assumptions are completely contradicted.
Absolutely.
Particularly in my world, when I do social research, like humans are just so unpredictable, right? Yeah. That's the challenge in the social sciences, is that we are to some extent, in large part, I think unpredictable, that we're always surprised sometimes, but you're right. You have to kind of look at it differently.
Yeah. We like to think we can predict our behavior, our beliefs. It's sure, on a general overview, yes, we can predict, but we don't even know ourselves. to truly understand yourself takes a lot of introspection over a long time, and you'll still surprise yourself. So it's no different. It's even more trying to understand other people.
So let's get at, how do you do that? And one of the ways, and the focus of our conversation today is on surveys as a tool, and the questionnaire and the development of that questionnaire as a process. And you've written a book, People Aren't Robots, and I highly recommend anyone who is either in our field of work or even someone who wants to know, you know, more about polling and market research and how to write a questionnaire and where the pitfalls are, should definitely pick it up. Now, like you, I'm sure I've answered my fair share of surveys over the years. I'm a nerd about it. I love taking surveys. I love seeing how different people ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I am still shocked at how often I think they are incredibly poorly written. That's not a way of saying it. They're just so bad, right? They're long, they're convoluted. And in the era of online surveys, where I can't ask the respondent, the interviewer on the phone to kind of speed it up, it just makes me want to click away, right? Just get through it and finish it, get my incentive and get the heck out of there. So
Sure. Maybe
as a starting point, what is it about questionnaire design that causes people like us, researchers, to write them in this way? Like, why do they actually... Why do these bad surveys exist in the first place?
I will confess that, along with you, I find it really strange. So as you and I are chatting right now, we're not using full sentences. We're interrupting each other a little bit. We use slang. We're, you know, using like filler words. So whatever, you get what I'm saying. And, you know, we know how to have a natural conversation with somebody face to face. But it seems like the second we get into the written word, into a written survey, we feel the need to go all Charles Dickens. This man could write page-long sentences, and it feels like we're trying to do the same thing with surveys, just in our attempt to be so ridiculously over-precise and robotic that we lose all sense of personal engagement. And we really need to remember that we're not writing prose here. We're trying to communicate with people in a way that makes them feel comfortable, engaged, important, valued. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen when we when we go all Charles Dickens on people. So it's a puzzle, and we need to get rid of that. We just need to stop it and rethink how we write when we truly want to communicate with people, not robots.
And I think it's worth saying that, and I feel this way, I don't know if you do, that the questionnaire writing is, I think, one of the most challenging tasks in public opinion, market research. Like, I think it's sometimes considered the throwaway, the easy part, right? And sometimes you're replicating questions, or you can cobble together stuff that's done before, but it is the hardest thing I do when I have a blank page and I know what the client wants. Or I know what the research question is, and then converting that into something, it's first really hard to learn how to do it. It's also, yep, as someone who's tried to teach it, very hard to teach. It's not something you can easily teach. So I guess to start this whole conversation is, why is that questionnaire so important to the whole research project? Like, I think it's the most important thing. Analysis is important. The data quality that comes out, but that questionnaire almost predicts those, or is not predicts, but is, without a good questionnaire, you can't have good analysis, right? Without good questions, you can't have good answers.
So I think you actually hit the nail on the head there when you said the questions predict the answers. Just the way we think about whatever the issue is, that becomes the question. Our personal skews, our personal biases become the questions. So if we're not taking extra care, special care, to make sure that our personal biases are removed from the questions, that our personal expertise with language, with our culture, with our experience in the world isn't removed, we need to watch for all of those things in the question, or we will end up, as you say, predicting the answers. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to predict the answers. We need to create questions that inspire creative thought and personal introspection. Our questions can't lead directly to an answer. If that's the case, there's no point asking a question. I know all the answers. I know exactly the answers I want to my questions. Just tell me what the questions are. So we really do need to make sure that the questionnaire itself is clean, can't be misunderstood, can't be misinterpreted, and doesn't create the answers, or doesn't create answers. It needs to be open so that people can share their true selves, true, right, opinions, and feel good about sharing those opinions.
And I think that's so important, you know, given, I think, the not crisis in the polling industry, more like in the public polls and the political polls, but to some extent, like, we're having a harder and harder time getting people just to talk to us, to share their, yeah, opinions, right? Yeah. Not only because, so if you were writing a questionnaire that makes me feel uncomfortable or is just awkward and strange and uses words I would never use, my instinct is already to kind of hold back and not share. And so we need to almost work harder in the opposite direction, right? Which means, I think, right. I agree with your kind of your thesis of the book, which is, you know, we have to be extra polite and extra courteous and make it so easy for people to do it, because I think increasingly over time, it's going to be harder to get people to share. Really good. So in your book, in the first chapter, you say, you know, what is the frame of mind that you need to have when you sit down and write a questionnaire? And you really underscore seven, I'm going to call them principles or guiding lights into thinking about the actual person on the other end of that mm-hmm. questionnaire, the respondent. Mm-hmm. What should that somebody writing a questionnaire consider about the people themselves when they start to write a questionnaire?
It all comes down to, human beings are flawed with emotions and have concerns that have no relation to you. So we have family to look after, parents, kids to look after. We make mistakes. You know, the whole to err is human. We make typos. There's actually one part in the book where I know there are typos in the book. Of course there are. And there was one place where I was talking about typos, and of course I found a typo in that section. So it's just, I have to leave that typo in. This is the whole point of it. We make mistakes. Right. We forget things. So there is no perfect human. Something else about the whole research process. We really like to talk as an industry about bad research participants, bad subjects, which it really does infuriate me, because I do genuinely believe that the vast majority of people participating in research are doing so for good reasons. We know this. They volunteer their personal time. They donate. They help others. You know, they hold doors, return pencils, and do good things for people. They're not answering surveys just like, ha ha ha, I'm going to make them buy the wrong soap. That's not what people are about. So we know they want to do good. We know they're busy. They have other things that are vastly more important than answering a survey, especially today, you know, trying to work with kids at home, trying to care for elderly parents. There are so many issues happening at the same time, and we still think people are going to take 20 minutes out of their day to put 100% of their brain effort into thinking about the three brands of soap that I've purchased over the past year. Like, nobody cares about that but you, the researcher. And you know that very well. When we become the research subject ourselves, when we answer a survey ourselves, we're like, I don't know. Check any box.
So true.
We really need to remember that the people we are talking to are flawed human beings, just like me. So we need to make sure we're using all the empathy that we want other people to have for us. We need to use that for our research participants.
So in the book, you go into actually great detail and very specific pieces of a questionnaire on if you take that philosophy that people are flawed, they're busy, they're impatient, they're imperfect, but they're generally good. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get you to go through every piece of advice that you give, but, you know, maybe a few examples of how that then converts into the choices you then should make when designing a questionnaire. And maybe we can do it by thinking about the very worst questionnaires we've ever seen and saying, this is why you shouldn't do that. And you know, do you have some examples that you can share about like what not to do and therefore what you should do as a result?
Sure. One of the biggest things I tell people to do is to look through every single question and ensure there is some kind of opt out. So you might think, which brands of soap did you buy in the last year? As if I could even remember what I bought in the last year. And you might list out basically every single brand. Let's say there are 10 brands, you list out every single brand. But my world of every single one of the 10 brands is not the entire world. I don't know your world, which includes online shopping, which includes 50 brands from, you know, 50 other countries. So if we're not open to recognizing that I don't know everything, we're not going to include those opt-out questions, the don't knows, none of the above, more than this, less than this. There always needs to be an answer option that lets somebody legitimately say, you don't know my opinion, it's not in this list. And it happens so often. I guess one of my favorite questions on a survey, I've gotten a few automotive surveys, and just to see how things play out, like, I have a rule about surveys. I will answer them, but I will not click on that final submit button if I know I've not been able to be truly honest. So it's in some of them, they'll go through my considerations for purchasing an automobile. Where do I drive? Do I drive in the day, at night? What kinds of vehicles would I drive? You know, a good 15-minute survey on cars. I have a driver's license that I got when I was like 22. I've never had a car in my life. I don't drive, have never bought one. There's not one sitting out. I can show you my bus pass. But the simple fact of they're not asking, do you have a car at the beginning of the survey? They just automatically assume, of course you have a car. This is North America. This is Canada. Everybody has a car. So there are some things we just take for granted and we forget. They really do need some kind of opt-out. It's so essential.
I want to just give you an example. So imagine you're completing an online survey on your desktop.
Yeah.
And we'll talk in a moment about technology and the move to mobile and what that means for design choices. But you started the survey, you've answered a few questions, simple, you know, multiple choice, no grid. And for the listeners, a grid, you know, is as you imagine it, you've got columns, you got rows, and you get to a page that has 30 rows and five columns across. Okay. So just for listeners, because this is audio, imagine on your screen, you've got agree, disagree statements and 30 of them listed all down the slide, all down the screen. Annie, what from your psychology training, do you think the average typical respondent person will do when they see that screen? Will they read each statement carefully and consider, do I actually agree? Maybe for the first three or four, but when you get to number 26.
By three or four, you have a sense of whether this person has phrased every question in a certain way. Do you like this? Is it pretty? Is it nice? Is it good? And once you realize, you know what, I'm answering four to the first several questions, I'm going to just run a four all the way down because I think I like all of the features of this thing. That's just one of the things. We're going to get some real straight lining on a question like that. At the same time, I'm really grateful you said that there are only five columns instead of seven or 11 columns. That is still very common. A lot of survey writers will still do an 11-point scale, which I think is horrific. And I think it's mean. I really do think it's mean. It's putting the researcher's needs ahead of people. And that's just one more way you're going to end up with bad data. That whole line of the column of force. There are so many ways you can fix that. Like one of the problems, if you think about that grid, five columns, 30 rows, you know, pick up your mobile device. Do you really think you're going to scroll through that big chart on your device? No, that's where you're closing the page and moving on to something else. That question needs to be converted into five questions instead of 30. and then those five questions need to be converted into five individual questions that don't necessarily all have the agree-disagree scale, because chances are they aren't truly agree-disagree questions. So there's so many ways to fix it.
I find sometimes it's just the researcher being lazy or just sticking with what they've always done and not really thinking about how is this going to come across to the respondent.
And
I think a lot of the software now does convert, you know, those kinds of grids into that more friendly experience on mobile. And I think the shift to mobile we're seeing, and you can probably confirm this, we see in our research, you know, 60 to 70% of the surveys that we're doing online are now being done on a mobile device. So if it's not mobile enabled, if you aren't testing your survey on a mobile device before you launch it, then you're really risking, you know, the data quality. And that's what this is all about. Like, we want to treat the respondent with respect. We want them to continue to share their opinions. But we also want the data to be good. And there's no point when your client's spending thousands of dollars or you're investing thousands of dollars into this research. And you know instantly when you open a data set, whether it was written well or not, because there's no variation in some of these, you know, it's 4, 4, 4, 4, 4. And then you run a segmentation analysis and they all like fit, not because of actually what they think or how they behave, but just how they answered the survey becomes the sorting features, right?
Yeah. I love to run a standard deviation on grid questions. And basically, if the standard deviation is less than like 1.1, you're guaranteed that they've just straight lined. And that the data is garbage, not because the participant is lazy or couldn't take care. It is solely because the researcher is lazy and didn't take care. We cannot pass the buck to participants who are doing this for us in their spare time for essentially free.
And even if they're not, and there's still a lot of incentives built in, if you get to a point where, and I've done a number of these kinds of surveys, not written them because I would never put my respondents through that or the people through that, but you know, so we talked about that grid. Now imagine doing that grid for 8 different brands that you were aware of. At that point, you actually start to get mad. And that's when you actually not just straight line, you start just randomly selecting numbers and saying, I'm going to just, you know, I don't do that. I don't encourage anyone to do that. But the psychology of it just says, I am mad. You have made me mad now. And I'm going to get my incentive because you've made me wait for 10 minutes. And I'm just going to finish this and lie to you and just not even lie, just because lie actually is an active decision. I'm just going to spray answers all over that page, right? Yep. And that's so important to recognize that the decisions we're making can have that effect. So given all your experience over 20 years doing this and, you know, what you learned in the process of writing your book and reflecting on this, I'm going to do a little kind of survey technique or qualitative technique on you.
Oh no.
Fill in the blanks for me. And you can fill in and it's hard to do again. This is not a visual exercise, but a good questionnaire, ... Finish that.
Okay. So I probably should keep my open end to fit within the text box. So I'm going to say it is short, clear, and respectful. And as we've discussed, I think we have a long way to go on all three of those categories.
I agree. Yeah. Let's before we wrap up and just finish up with a final question I have about your process. We talked a lot about the psychology of the respondents, the people who answer our surveys, but let's just dwell a little on the psychology of us researchers, right? Like there is a reason that surveys are too long. It's because we have a lot of questions and we love asking questions and we want to know more and we want to know, but we can't stop ourselves sometimes from saying, I don't need more than this, right? Do you find yourself kind of often, like I find myself in that trap where I will write a questionnaire the first draft and it's way too long. I know it's way too long.
Yeah.
And I've gotten into the habit now of trying to start smaller and instead of start big and try to cut, just don't write the big behemoth survey in the first place. But there is a psychology about us researchers being, I think, so curious that we can't help ourselves. Do you agree with that?
I'm the same. Like once you start with one question, it brings to mind five more, and each of those brings to mind five more, and so on, and so on, and you know how that goes. but what you really need to focus on are two things. What are your research objectives for real? And what is the outcome you expect to happen for real? So for example, you can ask all those questions, but if you aren't going to do a single thing about any of them, if you aren't going to consider a new social program, change a social program, change your target audience, then don't ask those questions. Don't waste everybody's time. Think about what you're actually willing and able to do and focus there first and mainly. If you are able to get that focus from the beginning of the questionnaire writing process, awesome. If you have to write a 20-page survey before you can get it back down to 2 pages, so be it.
which is way harder to do, I think. But nonetheless, everyone's got their process. Can a questionnaire be fun to complete and also meet the kind of standards of replicability and scientific inquiry? Like, I think the answer is yes, but I'm curious what your view is. Can it be fun from the respondent's perspective?
100% yes, and 100% they should be enjoyable to answer. This is part of the problem. I'll say half of our problem is that we never share the results back with participants. So what's the incentive to know that they've actually had an impact on the world? They don't know. Mm-hmm. So that part of the incentive is gone. And the other part of the incentive is for most people, surveys are fun and we should be making them fully fun, not just, you know, answering a question helps you think about who you are and your place in the world. It can be fun. So I've done this myself in lots of surveys. You know, when you get halfway through a survey, even if it's a 10-minute survey, once you get to the 5-minute point, you can say things like, wow, what a great job. We're so happy that you've gotten this far. You're almost there. Like there's no need for that to be formal and professional Charles Dickens. Mm-hmm. You can insert some casual language. If your issue is somehow kids' social programs, it can be very appropriate for you to don't make the language childish or silly, but recognize that you can have a little fun with the language. You can be more casual with the language. Something you can do is if you're going to talk about zero, you might say, you have to keep in mind, of course, language, potential language issues, but things like zero, zilch, nada. You know, if there are ways to just insert little bits of fun language, absolutely do it.
So I want to end, and this has been so good. My students in my class are not, you know, pros like us who've been doing this a long time. When you've done it for, you know, I've been doing it for over 10 years, questionnaire writing comes naturally, right? It's like writing anything. If you're a journalist, you could write something in no time. You're just used to it. But if you've never done it, it is a scary, scary thing to see that blank screen kind of looking at you. Where do we start? So I guess to end is almost where you start is, you know, when you're getting ready to write a questionnaire, do you have a process that you follow that helps you think get you to a place where you're actually, you know, getting it done, and it's coming out the way you want it to.
All right. So I touched on this a little bit already. I start at the very beginning and I start at the very end. What do you hope to achieve and what do you hope to action on? Once you know both sides of the issue, the beginning and the end, then you can start filling in the blanks. I'm not so concerned about a big empty page. I have the same philosophy as with just writing in general. And even with writing a book, just throw words on a page. Really, sometimes you're just stuck, you don't know where to start. Throw words on a page. When you get a few questions in there, you'll start seeing what your flow is. Mm-hmm. You'll see which of your research objectives are getting covered, which objectives you're missing. If you've got those objectives in place, then you can just start throwing words to each of them. I know that sounds really really casual, not professional, but sometimes you just need to get words on a page to get going.
Yeah, no, and I agree. My process is kind of, I mean, I think we have to also say that you can't write a questionnaire if you know nothing about the subject, right?
Right.
And so one of the great things about our work is we become kind of experts on a lot of things. We have to be not deep experts, but expert enough that we can draft a questionnaire that explores the topic. And in order to explore a topic, you have to kind of know it really well, right? And so what I do now is I just kind of scour the internet on whatever topic it is and try to get, like what you said, listen or read about different perspectives or different angles.
Yep.
And I just kind of start copy pasting phrases and words and sort of dropping them in the page as the same kind of thing. Just get content there, get ideas on that page, and then you sort of stitch them all together. And once you get a rhythm going, that's where you get into trouble that you can't stop. You can go down five different off ramps and you're exploring things. But once you get going, once that light goes off, that you've figured out how to get at the question that your client or you're interested in answering, it does feel great, but it's sometimes hard to get there. And I've struggled with projects. So
social media is a great way to find your edge points. You know what you know, but it's not till you search out elsewhere that you see your gaps and can fill those in. So once you've got both put together, you'll have a much more full and thorough questionnaire to work with.
Well, on that note, Annie Petit, I thank you so much, Dr. Petit, for your time for this book, because I think it's really important. And
I have to interrupt you. Yes. You said my name wrong.
Oh, correct me.
Annie Pettit.
Pettit.
Yes.
It's my, I guess being in Ottawa, sometimes you always think people have a French name when they don't.
Yes.
Right? Well, Dr. Pettit, I appreciate. I'm not a robot. I make mistakes. We've talked about that today, and that's good. And I think I don't teach research methods in social sciences anymore. But now, having read this book over the last few years, it should be on the course syllabus because it's a good counter to the more academic kind of social research that's taught in terms of how do you ask questions. And I think, you know, the basic premise that you've identified is just think about the respondent as a person and ask yourself, how would you feel if you were asked these questions? And you'd be surprised at how many you'd change as a result of that. And that to me is the most important piece of advice. So thank you for spending some time with us. And I look forward to seeing what you do next on your journey to make our research world better at what we do. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been great fun chatting with you.